Hey there, it's Kona Gallagher, host of And Then They Were Gone and Day by Day True Crime Stories, and I'm here to bring you an amazing opportunity to win some incredible prizes, all for a good cause. Join the Texas Advocacy Project's The Big Game Football Squares Raffle on February 9th, 2025, and help support survivors of power-based abuse. For every $100 donation, you secure a square and a chance to win amazing prizes. You can choose from two exciting grids. The Hawaiian Paradise Grid offers a grand prize of a seven-night stay for two at a luxury resort in Oahu or the Big Island. Or play the Beachfront Mexico Grid for a chance to win a four-night, all-inclusive stay for two at a five-star Marival Luxury Resort in Banderas Bay or Nuevo Nayarit, Mexico. Your contributions help survivors understand their rights, navigate the justice system, and secure emergency protective orders. To participate, visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org and select your grid today. Don't miss out. Tune in to the Texas Advocacy Project's Facebook page on February 9th, 2025, during the game for live updates on winners. Prizes are awarded at the end of each quarter, with the grand prize at the game's conclusion. So score big for a cause. Visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org to learn more.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
On November 20th, 1987, Lewis and Susan Zaharias had an argument. By this point, fights weren't uncommon for the couple, who had been married for 6 years. Susan was a stay-at-home mom with two small children who was feeling isolated while her husband worked long hours far away. But this day was different. Susan was acting paranoid and not like herself. After a violent altercation, Lewis left home to give his wife some space. When he returned a few hours later, she and their children were gone. What began that day was a journey that has completely changed the trajectory of Lewis's life. He spent every single day for nearly 37 years looking for his children. Lewis firmly believes that his kids are out there, but has no idea if they even know they're missing. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Christopher and Lisa Zaharias. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the ones you have at home. This week's story is another listener request. We don't cover a lot of family abductions on the show, but this is one of the oldest unsolved family abductions in the country. This happened in 1987, and the story of the Vossler children, which we covered last season, happened in 1986. In both cases, the other parent believes that their now grown children are still out there. While it's likely that the Vossler boys have no idea who they really are, some evidence suggests that the Zaharias children may at least have a pretty good idea.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Before we get started, though, we've had a new member join us over on Patreon, so we want to give a shout out to Jenna H. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you so much.
Remember, if you join us on there at any level, starting at just $2 a month, you can get these episodes ad-free and also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. Now, with that out of the way, let's get into the story of Christopher and Lisa Zaharias. Christopher Lewis Zaharias was born on March 25th, 1984. His little sister, Lisa May Zaharias, followed on August 18th, 1986, meaning that she just celebrated her 38th birthday the weekend before this airs. Their parents are Louis and Susan Zaharias. Louis and Susan met in August 1977 at Western State University Law School. Susan Gammel, Gammel's her maiden name, was working as a receptionist there. It was her first day as a receptionist, and it was Louis's first day as a law student.
Oh.
Susan is originally from Wetumpka, Oklahoma, and comes from what has been called a, quote, oil wealthy family.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Susan's father, Orville Gammel, owns Gammel Oil Company, and this fact does become important later. Perhaps due to their oil wealth, the Gammel family was not fond of Louis when Susan began dating him. Louis is an Italian Catholic from New York, while the Gammels are Dutch Reformed Baptists. According to Lou, they hated him from the beginning, but like many young loves, Susan was only 17 when they met, and Lou was 23.
Okay. I mean, not terrible, but...
I mean, very...
Not great.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I think in 1977, that was pretty common.
Yeah.
I mean, I think today, looking at it, you'd be like, you should not be dating a teenager. But again, 1977, it was a very different time. But they were both very young, you know, neither one of their frontal lobes was fully developed. So they didn't care who disapproved. They were in love. And, you know, Lou said, like, it was love at first sight. Like, he immediately knew that this is the woman he wanted to marry. The pair moved in together. And then on June 6th, 1981, they were married. The couple settled in Mission Viejo, California. And everything was wonderful for a while. And Lou has called Susan his best friend. But the couple experienced challenges early on. So in the early years of their relationship, the two partied. And this is partying in the late 70s. So it was party with a capital P.
Mm-hmm.
And
or a capital C.
Yes, actually, that is correct, because Lou did struggle with a cocaine addiction. It got so bad that he actually OD'd and credits Susan with literally saving his life that day. This event was a reality check for them both, and in 1982, the young couple actually moved to New York for several years to be closer to Lou's family. He went to rehab during that time, and Susan became pregnant with Christopher and gave birth to him in 1984. So I believe that he said they were in New York for a total of 3 years. And at some point during that, he went to rehab, he got out, you know, got a great job. They were close to his family and decided to start their family.
Now, had he finished law school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So he did finish law school before that, which I think is why they didn't move until 1982. So I think they probably stayed in California long enough for him to finish law school and then went to New York.
What a blight on the family, a lawyer.
I know, right?
Not an oil tycoon.
Yeah. Now, I will say he never did become a lawyer. He did work in the legal profession, but he never passed the bar exam, or he never took the bar exam. But, you know, he never officially became a lawyer. But still, like, he was a respectable guy. In New York, Lou got a job at MetLife, the insurance company, and he worked in their Manhattan office and luckily was able to take a transfer from their Manhattan office to an office in Orange, California. So the family moved back in 1985, and then Lisa was born in 1986.
Got it.
Yeah. So Christopher born in New York, Lisa born in California. Having two small children that close together in age is difficult for any parent. It's especially difficult when your co-parent, in this case Lou, has a job that's 2 hours away from your home.
Whoa.
Yeah. So
why did they move to Orange then?
I have no idea.
There's got to be some place affordable in between Orange and
Los Angeles is where he was working. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But I mean, 2 hours does seem like a lot.
2 hours one way?
Yeah. So he was gone up to 15 hours a day.
Yeah. That's outrageous.
Yeah. So it should come as no surprise that Susan started feeling isolated and was likely depressed. Susan's family had moved from Oklahoma to Chino, California, and that's where she was living when she and Lou started dating. So I don't know what made them move to California in the first place, but when she and Lou met, remember, she was only 17, so she was still living at home when she got this receptionist job, and she was living with at least one of her siblings at the time as well. But after she and Lou got together, the whole family was like, screw it, we hate California, and moved back to Oklahoma.
I mean, that's wild.
Yeah.
I mean, there had to have been other reasons, right?
No,
I know. It wasn't just because they were dating that they moved to Oklahoma.
I would assume so, but I have no idea. So Chino, where Susan was living, is only an hour away from Mission Viejo. So like they could have helped out had they been there.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time they moved back from New York and the kids were born, like her parents and siblings were long gone. But according to them, you know, Lou stole their daughter and broke up their family. Susan befriended a woman across the street, and while this started out as a way for Susan to have like some adult interaction during the day, it seems to have also been the beginning of the problems that Susan would later face.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets, which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
According to Lou, his wife, who had once helped him with his drug addiction, succumbed to one of her own. The neighbor whom Susan had befriended was dating a drug dealer, and the two women started to have what they called coffee breaks during the day. But caffeine was not their pick-me-up. According to Lou, it was cocaine and crystal meth.
Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, not that cocaine is better for you, but like, good God, jumping to crystal meth.
Yeah, yeah. So, and apparently it got really bad. But Lou admits that he didn't notice his wife's problem at first, but says that he later learned it actually started during her pregnancy with Lisa May. Yeah. Lisa was born prematurely and had to spend an additional 10 days in the hospital. Because Lou worked such long hours, Susan was left in charge of the children and the household expenses. As her substance use disorder progressed, she began to use money set aside for household bills on drugs. Now, to be clear, Lou was not the only one who has made these allegations. Two of Susan's friends have also corroborated this. And I believe that these are also the friends who ended up telling Lou the whole story, quote unquote, about Susan's drug use. And this whole thing was later proven by a forensic accountant. So Susan apparently hid their financial issues from her husband by renting a post office box and having all the overdue bills sent there instead of to their home.
That's some planning there.
Yeah.
Some forward thinking.
Yeah. A lot of what I'm talking about, you know, from Lou's perspective comes from a 2022 podcast that he did with his private investigator, where he really just lays out the whole story from his perspective. And he admits, he's like, listen, at that time, like, yeah, I worked really long hours. I wasn't around. There was a lot that I missed. And when I was home, I just wanted to hang out with the kids. And so I really wasn't paying attention to Susan like I should have been. So he fully admits he missed a lot during, you know, the months and years leading up to this. By 1987, everything was coming to a head. Susan was facing legal trouble for writing over $6,000 in bad checks. She wasn't making car payments or paying the utilities. She was also growing more reckless and allegedly left Christopher and Lisa May alone in the car while she was buying drugs. That November, Lou's mother came to visit them for Thanksgiving and arrived around November 16th. It sounds as though Lou was still going to work the first few days that his mom was in town, because she came in like a full week plus before Thanksgiving. So yeah. She came November 16th, and then like there was a weekend, and then it was the week of Thanksgiving. So Lou still had to work. So his mom was with Susan and the kids all day. Now, while his mom was there, someone from the water company came by and said that, you know, the bill hadn't been paid. A neighbor also came over and said that Susan had bounced a check that she had written them for some reason. An auto mechanic also called the house looking for money. So,
jeez, that's like one. I mean, that's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. And so Lou's mom told her son about all of this. And on the evening of November 19th, he confronted Susan. It did not go well. She stormed upstairs and refused to talk to anyone for the rest of the night. The next morning, November 20th, Susan was acting paranoid. At around 7 a.m., she told Lou that she needed to come with him to get his paycheck, but that she didn't want to leave his mother in the house because she was afraid that she'd start going through her belongings.
I mean, so aside from just the general paranoia of being on drugs, what was the thought process there?
That she needed money, but she didn't trust Lou's mom. Lou tried to reassure his wife that his mother wasn't going to just start rifling through her stuff, but Susan wouldn't let up. Lou said that she followed him into the shower, still ranting. This continued downstairs as Lou was having breakfast. That's when it became violent. Lou says that Susan started kicking and punching him. He says that he was terrified because even though he is much larger than she was, he weighed about 275 pounds, while Susan, who was 5'7", at that point was down to like 90 pounds. He couldn't stop her.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's meth.
Yeah, but that freaked him out, as you can imagine, because like he's this big dude.
Yeah.
And so if a tiny 90 pound woman's coming at you, you know, you're going to think like, okay, I can handle this. But like he couldn't. So what's worse is that everyone in the house was watching this happen.
Oh, she like did this in front of the kids and
yeah,
everything?
Yeah, this is in the kitchen, like while Lou was having breakfast.
Jesus.
Lou's mom was holding Lisa May, who's a baby. And Lou's mom's freaking out, of course. And then Christopher was just there. He's a toddler. And he's just like, what is happening? You know, asking everybody, like, what's mommy doing? What's daddy doing? Like, what is going on? Since he couldn't defuse the situation, Lou decided that he had to leave. When he left the house, he was bleeding from scratches on his arms and neck. So he couldn't go to work. Like, he was just a mess, like physically, emotionally, all of it.
Yeah.
So instead, he checked into a nearby Comfort Inn and called into work and said that he wasn't coming in that day. He cleaned himself up, and after a few hours, he decided to go back home, hoping that his mother had managed to calm Susan down. But that's not what he walked back into. Lou and Susan lived in a condo at the time, and when Lou pulled up to the building, he saw his mother lying on the sidewalk outside.
I mean, unconscious?
Well, I think she was conscious by that point, but yeah, it sounds like she might have been unconscious at some point of this. When he asked his mother what had happened, she said that Susan told her that she was taking Christopher to school and she was going to bring Lisa May with her. Lou's mom said, you know, she didn't need to bring the baby and that she would stay with her while she went and dropped Christopher off.
Makes sense.
Well, exactly. This seemingly led to an argument, though, with Lou's mother following Susan to the building's exit. According to her, Susan punched her, threw her down the steps of the building, and left with both of the children.
Jesus.
Yeah, and Lou said that his mom was like out there for like an hour because by that time, everybody around had kind of already gone to work or school or wherever, so
nobody
saw
was
her.
There. Nobody yeah. saw her. Oh, my God.
Yeah, because this is a Friday morning. But as you can imagine, Susan didn't take Christopher to school. She had a much different plan. In between the time Lou left and the altercation with his mother, which happened about an hour or so later, Susan called her sister, Juliana Nosel. The story she told her was extremely different from the one that we heard from Lou. Susan told Juliana that Lou had beaten her and that she was afraid for her and her children's lives. She said that the mafia was going to kill her.
What mafia?
Well, this is something that Susan apparently told several people, including the two friends that I mentioned earlier, that Lou had mafia connections and that they would kill her if she ever tried to leave.
Just because he's from New York?
Yeah, in Italian.
Oh my God, stereotype.
So Susan told this to Juliana and said that she had to take the children and escape. Juliana seemingly believed the story to the point where she actually called the police from where she was living and like sent them over to the condo. Once the police arrived, Lou and his mother gave their side of the story, which was seemingly corroborated by their injuries.
Yeah.
His mother filed a report against Susan for assault and battery. Lou also tried to file a report for parental kidnapping, but since they were married, he couldn't. Like, you can't parentally kidnap your children when you're still married. Like, you have custody of them. If you want to leave with them, you can leave with them. Lou said he instantly knew that his wife didn't intend on coming back. So he tried to figure out where she had gone. They didn't let very many people watch their kids, but one exception was Susan's grandmother, who lived in Lake Elsinore, California, which was only about an hour away. Lou jumped in the car and drove over, but the house was empty and locked up tight. So now let's just take a moment to look at this from the Gamble family's perspective. They already didn't like Lou.
Mm-hmm.
He was a 23-year-old Italian who had convinced their 17-year-old daughter to move out of their house and move in with him. They had already accused him of breaking up their family. Then they got into drugs. Like, and according to Lou, I mean, he says that he and Susan were both doing drugs, although at the beginning, it does sound like he was doing a lot more than she was.
Sure.
Again, this got so bad that Lou OD'd in 1979. So then after all this happens, he somehow managed to, you know, graduate law school. But then he took Susan and moved her to the other side of the country.
Yeah, I was going to say that while it was probably the smart move for them to get clean,
mm-hmm.
not the best from her family's side.
Exactly. So they moved her to the other side of the country, to New York City, which I'm sure they weren't thrilled about in general.
I don't know. These guys live outside of L.A.
Yeah, well. So then after they moved back to California, that's when she started telling her family that Lou had mafia ties and he was abusive. And I don't know exactly, like, timeline-wise when she started telling people that, but it wasn't something that came out of nowhere on November 20th, 1987. So it's not as though when she called her sister and she's like, Lou has mafia ties, he's going to kill me, you know, that Juliana's like, what the hell are you talking about? This is insane. Because Susan had been saying things like this for a while.
Which makes you wonder why, I mean, unless she was playing the long game with using that as an excuse to leave him, why would that have come up?
It is interesting because I do wonder, like, what her motive was. Like, did she believe this on some level? And I will say that after all of this happened, right, and Lou was filing for divorce and going, you know, starting to do things through the courts, that CPS did an investigation. Like, there were investigations into him, and nobody found, like, any evidence that he was abusive to Susan, that he was abusive to the children. Obviously, he didn't have mafia ties, you know. So there's never evidence of any of this.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not sure.
I'd be curious to find out if any of these allegations that she was making about him being involved in the mafia started around the same time that she started using drugs.
Right, right. I mean, because that would make sense, right?
Yeah.
On some level.
I mean, it's not going to make any rational, real sense, because when you're on drugs, you know, yeah, all rational thought is out the window.
Yeah, I don't know, but it really worked in her favor at this point, because everybody was inclined to believe her. So on that morning when Susan called her sister in a panic, it makes sense that the entire Gamble family galvanized to help her and the children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would think that in that moment, on that day, they 100% believed that they were helping her. They were doing the right thing.
Yeah. And I mean, this is also an opportunity for them to get their family member, not just daughter, sister.
Yeah,
back.
Exactly. And, you know, they wanted the kids, like, they never liked Lou in the first place. And so they're like, yeah, any excuse to get you and the kids the hell out of there. Perfect. Love it. Let's do it. And what Lou wouldn't find out until later was that they all worked together to get Susan and the children out of California. Lou started trying everything he could to get Susan and his kids back. At this point, he was hoping to salvage the marriage and get, you know, his entire family back together. He started going to the courts, filing for separation with mediation in hopes of, one, making her appear. Because if they're official court documents that she could be served with, then, you know, it would compel her to come back to the state.
Right.
But he wanted mediation because, like, he truly was trying to save his marriage at this point. But she couldn't be located to be served.
Right.
At one point, Lou called his sister-in-law Juliana's house. He spoke with her husband, Reverend John Nosel, and begged him to help. Lou has said that at the time, he was still trying to protect Susan, so he didn't mention the drugs when he was talking to his brother-in-law.
Mm.
He just said that he thought Susan was sick and needed help.
Which I would imagine is going to come back to bite him in the ass.
Yeah, basically.
Like, if their family didn't know she was strung out, they're just going to believe everything that she says.
Of course. Of course. John told Lou that the last he had heard, Susan and the kids were in a battered woman's shelter. By November 24th, 1987, 4 days later, Lou wasn't the only one looking for Susan. Because he was able to file for a separation, the parental kidnapping case was allowed to move forward and a warrant was issued for Susan's arrest. In addition, she had another warrant out for her arrest for check fraud. There were around 8 counts, one of which was a felony. So basically, if the police found Susan at this point, like if she got pulled over while driving, for instance, she would have been arrested and the children would have gone to Lou. So she needed to make sure that that didn't happen. What Lou found out later through various civil lawsuits, which we'll talk more about, was that the Gamble family all worked together. Instead of going to her grandmother's house, remember when Lou jumped into the car, that was the first place he went? She went to Riverside, California to her aunt's house, and her grandmother met them there. In Riverside, she filed a police report accusing Lou of abuse.
So now we have mismatching police reports in 2 different jurisdictions.
Right.
But one jurisdiction has multiple arrest warrants out, one of which is extraditable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They then flew to Oklahoma to Susan's parents' house. And it was later proved that Susan's parents paid for those plane tickets. After spending a few days there, they went to Detroit, Michigan. It's unclear how long she was in Detroit, but she ultimately ended up at her sister's house in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and stayed there for a few weeks.
Greensburg?
Greensburg, right outside of Pittsburgh.
I'm familiar.
Yeah. And apparently when Lou called her brother-in-law and he was like, I don't know, last time I heard she was in a battered woman's shelter, Susan and the kids were actually there at his house.
Sitting in the kitchen.
Yeah, in Greensburg. But after that, the trail went cold.
So I'm curious, how did any of them find out that she had these warrants out for her arrest?
I don't know when they found that out.
Okay. But so at some point they found out, which is why they started basically shipping her around.
No, I think they were shipping her around simply to hide her from Lou.
Oh, interesting.
I don't think that actually had anything to do with the warrants at that point. Because while the warrants were filed, you know, very soon after she left, like I don't think that they necessarily knew about that.
Interesting.
And I don't know when Susan herself found out about the warrants, but she already knew that she was in trouble for these checks. Like that was something that she knew was going to catch up with her at some point.
Yeah. So I'm sure she was,
she's not going to share that with her family.
No. And I'm sure she was saying again, the same thing, like he's abusive. He's going to come and find me and the kids and take us away.
Yeah.
Hide me. Yeah.
Yeah. Police in Orange County did begin to take the investigation seriously, but it wasn't enough for Lou. He poured all of his money into private investigators and did everything he could think of to find his kids. In early 1988, the stress and grief caused him to have a nervous breakdown for which he was hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital. This was the first of 3 similar hospitalizations over the years. Lou couldn't bear to remain in the home that he had shared with Susan and their children, so he moved to an apartment in Thousand Oaks, California, about a year after the abduction. By that time, he had already sold most of his furniture and other belongings in order to afford his attorneys and investigators. By 1989, Lou had been granted a divorce and officially had custody of his children, but he had no idea where they were. Then, in the summer of 1989, Lou was faced with a horrifying possibility when the body of a little girl was found washed up on the shore of the San Francisco Bay. The little girl was found on May 24, 1988. She was fully clothed and was estimated to be 12 to 18 months old. Lisa May was 15 months old when her mother took her. When no one came forward to claim the body, police started looking into missing persons cases to try to narrow down who it could be. As they went down the list, everyone was checked off until they got to Lisa May Zaharias. Police notified Lou of the possible connection to his daughter on June 27, 1989, over a year after the body was found. Lou didn't really believe that it was his daughter, but did say that the composite sketch resembled her. Unfortunately, because DNA testing was in its infancy, testing against Lou couldn't rule out the possibility that the baby was Lisa. Lou lived with the uncertainty of this unidentified child for the next 4 years.
Oh my God. That's awful. I can't imagine that.
No. I mean,
they couldn't do dental records or anything. Well,
yeah, no, because she had, yeah, the baby wouldn't have been to the dentist yet.
Yeah. Shit.
And in that 4 years, like, nobody came forward and say, oh, hey, like, I think this is X, Y, or Z child. So for 4 years, he lived with this. Again, not believing really that it was his daughter.
Not knowing is enough.
No, exactly. He said it was an absolute hell. But then the science of DNA advanced to the point where she was positively identified, and it wasn't Lisa May. After years of not getting anywhere with the criminal arm of the justice system, Lou turned to the civil courts in search of answers. He filed one suit against Susan and her family, in which he was awarded a $3.4 million judgment against his now ex-wife, but obviously he had no way of collecting.
Yeah. Even if they knew where she was, like, she didn't have that kind of money anyway.
No, no, not at all. He had better luck suing Susan's aunt and grandmother, remember?
Yeah.
Who helped her leave California.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He won a sealed settlement from them. He won another sealed settlement against Susan's brother-in-law, Reverend John Nosel, who hid Susan and the children in his Greensburg, Pennsylvania home. By the way, he also used to be a pastor in Detroit, which is why they had ended up
in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lou also sued Susan's parents for harboring her, but that case was dismissed. It's hard to say why that case was dismissed as opposed to the one against the grandma and the aunt, because the reason given for dismissing the case against Susan's parents was that they helped her so quickly after she left that they weren't aware they were doing anything wrong. So basically, they made the argument. They're like, what? I bought my daughter a plane ticket. Like, what's wrong with that? Because.
Yeah, but the sister and aunt.
I know.
Came first.
And that's the thing. And I don't understand. And it could be the difference between the case being in Oklahoma with the parents versus California for the sister and aunt. Because keep in mind, we're dealing with three different states here. So the suit against the sister and aunt was California. The suit against the brother-in-law was Pennsylvania. The suit against the parents was Oklahoma. And the parents are very prominent in Oklahoma. So I don't know. But basically, they got out of it because they're like, listen, all we did was buy a plane ticket for our daughter.
Well, we also don't know when that plane ticket was purchased.
Well, we know it was within like the first couple of days, right? So that was before he had filed the separation. It was before there was even a case about parental kidnapping. So you can kind of understand why, from a legal perspective, they would have been in the clear. But again, why? He won against the grandmother and the aunt. Yeah, so I don't know where the difference is there. In a 1998 Ventura County Star article, so we're talking 11 years after the disappearance, Susan's father, Orville Gamble, spoke to the reporter, though he declined to discuss the allegations against him and his wife outright. But what he did say was pretty interesting. According to Gamble, he hadn't spoken to his daughter since 1987 and had no idea where she was. He said, quote, "We just had to write it off and forget about her. Not a day goes by I don't think about it," end quote. Which is just a weird thing to say about your missing daughter.
Yeah, we wrote her off. I think about her.
Yeah. Okay.
I think he knows.
Oh, yeah. When asked if he was still searching for his daughter and grandchildren, he said, quote, if I find her, I wouldn't tell anybody anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you just admit your guilt?
Yeah. It does appear that something along those lines may have happened in 2016. On January 27th, 2016, nearly 30 years after Susan took her kids and disappeared, her mother, Norma Jean Gamel, passed away. In her obituary, it lists Susan, Christopher, and Lisa among her survivors. Now, that could be wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Or it could mean that the family does know where they are, as has been long suspected. But more importantly, this made people start to talk. One witness said that a woman resembling Susan attended the funeral and followed directly behind the casket. In addition, tips came in that indicated Christopher and Lisa attended the funeral as well.
There was no law enforcement or private investigators at this point?
Oh, so I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
It doesn't sound like there was law enforcement, no. But the PIs were on it. On that 2022 podcast I talked about with Lou and his private investigators, they say that they were actually sticking out the funeral home the day prior to the funeral, hoping that Susan would show up. So she didn't. They were there from like 7 a.m., stayed the entire day until the funeral home closed. No Susan. So eventually they left. However, they later learned that a woman believed it to have been Susan called the funeral director after hours and begged him to let her in to say goodbye to her mother. The PIs apparently only missed her by about an hour.
Ugh. That's so rough.
And I think they were at the funeral or, you know, near the funeral, but I guess missed her. And again, the sighting of her and possibly the children at the funeral is a little shakier than that sighting the day before. So I'm not exactly sure, but there have been like reports of, you know, out of state license plates, like being at the funeral. And
that doesn't really indicate much.
Right. So they were so close to finding her, but that funeral was 8 years ago at this point. And Lou is still looking for his children. According to the private investigators, they've been working with a family member. And that family member says that at some point, the children were split up and were not raised as siblings.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know when that would have happened and who raised them or whatever. I mean, obviously somebody like within the family.
Yeah.
I don't think that they
split them up,
or anything like that.
Right.
So maybe they were raised as cousins, for instance. But yeah, according to this family member they're working with, the kids were not raised as siblings. And he also says that they were told their father is dead. Susan Gamel Zaharias is facing several felony charges. So I should back up and say that, you know, the warrant, the parental kidnapping warrant that was issued was out of California, but at some point a federal warrant was issued for her. So it's very much anywhere she goes at this point. So it makes sense that she's still hiding, even though her kids are
adults.
Very much adults. And it also sounds as though her family truly believed that she and the children were in danger in 1987, and they were doing what they thought was the right thing, which I get. I mean, like, I truly understand how in November 1987, the family galvanized and did everything they could to help Susan and the kids. Yeah, I don't blame them for that at all. Like, that to me makes perfect sense, given the information that they had at the time. But it's been nearly 37 years. Lou is not in prison for abusing another wife or mafia-related crimes. He left California and the law profession and moved to Arizona, where he reinvented himself as a kindergarten teacher. He volunteered at a domestic violence shelter and read to children. He never had any other kids of his own, and it's clear that a part of him died in 1987. I don't know if Chris and Lisa May know who they are. The obituary indicates that they might, but the other stories about them living apart tell me that they may have no idea. So it's hard to say, and there are different things. So we heard
the PIs say that, you know, the family member that they're working with said that the kids were split up and told that their fathers were dead.
So it makes you think that maybe they changed their names too.
Well, yeah.
Or at least, at the very least, the younger one, the daughter.
Right. And, but I mean, Christopher
obviously changed the last name, but.
Yeah. And Christopher was so young too, that he likely does not remember his father at all.
Yeah.
It's very plausible that they don't know who they are, but if they attended their grandmother's funeral,
yeah,
you know, then it sounds like they might have some sort of indication, you know,
yeah,
if not outright knowing. But it's hard to say, because if they do have an idea of who they are or know exactly who they are, they were raised thinking that their father is this horrible, terrifying person who they need to hide from.
Or who's now dead.
Or, yeah, exactly. So it's like, yeah, he's either really scary and is going to get them, or he's dead and it doesn't matter. But I think, I almost think that the father being dead makes more sense if they don't know their true identities.
Right.
Because I think that if they thought their father was dead and they do know their true identities,
then they would come out.
They would have come out by now,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And if they knew their true identities, a quick Google search will obviously show them that their father's alive and well and searching for them very actively.
Yeah.
Like,
I think it's far more likely that they don't know who they are.
Yeah, I think so too. Or know exactly who they are. Like, maybe they understand that they're a part of the Gamel family.
Yeah.
But not the whole story. And that is the one thing that struck me about this case, because we have covered a lot of older, you know, like decades and decades old cases. Like, so if you look at a case that happened in the 70s, 80s, even 90s or early 2000s, a lot of time when I'm researching them and I'm coming across like original news articles or articles within the first few years, and they're talking about, oh, we set up this website to help us find our missing loved one. A lot of times when I go to that website now, it's gone.
Sure.
Because they only keep it up for a certain number of years. And eventually they're like, okay, we're going to not maintain this website anymore. But this website that Lou created is still very active. The Facebook page that he created is still very active. Like I said, this podcast that I got a lot of the information for this episode from was from 2022. I don't know much about Lou right now. Like I said, I know he moved to Phoenix, he became a teacher, but the person who emailed me asking us to cover this case said that Lou is in poor health now.
Mm.
He's in his 70s.
Yeah.
And that, you know, all he wants before he dies is to find his kids. So if you're out there and you think that there's any possibility that you could be one of these children, then please send your DNA into Ancestry or 23andMe or anything. Lou has put his DNA in like every possible database. He spent his entire life looking for his children, whom he loves more than anything. He spent over $1 million on attorneys and investigators over the years, and the money that he did get from those civil suits has gone straight back into this cause. If you know where Christopher and or Lisa May are, please say something and let this man's nightmare end. I think at this point, family members are staying quiet because they want to protect Susan, because she is still facing legal issues. But like, keep hiding her, you know, leave her out of it. Like,
just let him know where his kids are.
Just, yeah.
Give him at the very least the opportunity to see them or meet them,
or just know that they're okay. So we're going to leave you this week with Lou. When asked what he would say to his children if given the chance, this is what he said.
I would say, Christopher and Lisa May,
take a breath.
Please just give me a chance, just a chance to be your dad or to be your friend if we can't go that far. And if we have grandchildren, please let me be some small part of my grandchildren's life.
Christopher Zaharias has been missing from Santa Ana, California since November 20th, 1987. He is a white male with blonde hair and blue eyes. He was approximately 3 feet tall and 40 pounds when he went missing. He was 3 years old when he was last seen. He would be 40 today. Lisa Mae Zaharias has been missing from Santa Ana, California since November 20th, 1987. She is a white female with blonde hair and blue eyes. She was approximately 2 feet tall and 20 pounds when she went missing. Lisa Mae was just a year old when she disappeared. She would be 37 today. The children may have been raised with the last name Gamel or Nosel. Anyone with information regarding the abduction or whereabouts of Christopher and Lisa Zaharias is asked to contact the Orange County District Attorney's Office at 714-834-3600. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel, because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.